proceed to the next case for argument, Eskew versus Astru. Mr. Rose.
Good morning, judges. My name is Ashley S. Rose. I'm representing the appellant in this case. I thought I would start out by emphasizing what I consider to be the importance of a Step 2 assessment, which is the basis for the assessments that occur in the subsequent steps in the familiar five-step evaluation process for determining whether a claimant for disability benefits is or is not disabled. Step two is sometimes referred to as a quote-unquote threshold step, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it is a de minimis step. Step two is the point at which...
Well, you're claiming that every ailment that she claims to have had to be examined in step two. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
That would extend to a lot of things, I gather.
Well, sometimes it does.
Why is that necessary?
Well, it's necessary because, first of all, because the regulations say so. And that the administrative law judges are bound by the rulings and regulations that the commissioner has propounded. But to direct my answer to your question is that the combination of impairments sometimes becomes a severe combination of impairments, which means that not only are there certain physical or mental impairments that significantly limit the ability of someone to work, to do SGA, substantial gainful activity, but also in combination with other impairments, which in and of themselves may not be severe, these other impairments may have an effect, a deleterious effect upon in combination with other more...
Well, isn't that step three, though? I mean,
why
do they have to do it on step two?
Because at step two, it provides the basis for going forward in each of the subsequent steps in relationship to what is required in those subsequent steps. For example, in this particular case, where the administrative law judge doesn't take into consideration such impairments as pulmonary hilar lymph nodes. He doesn't take into consideration hypoxia. And there are various other impairments that are hard to pronounce, but nevertheless must be taken into consideration. Now, at step three, if, as in this particular case, the ALJ stated that she does not meet a listing, he doesn't go on to the next required element of step three, which is 20 CFR 404.1526, which says that the claimant may have impairments that are equal in severity to that listed impairment, even though there may be some elements of the listing which are not met. Well, now, various things such as COPD, which is the part of the listing itself, but neoplasm of the lung might have some significance. But the ALJ does not take that into consideration. If he had done so at step two, then there may have been a step three equivalence evaluation, which might have benefited the claimant. But the way that the ALJ treated that particular step, that was not done, and so it skewed the outcome of the case. And step two evaluations also had to do with step four evaluations, where two things are done at step four. First of all, the ALJ is required to identify the residual functional capacity of the claimant, the RFC of the claimant, which is the most that the claimant can do despite his or her impairments. When the ALJ in this case comes to step four, what he does is what a lot of ALJs do is say, well, I've accommodated the problems that the claimant, Ms. Eskew, has presented with by reducing the RFC, by placing restrictions upon it so that she can't climb ladders and can't climb scaffolds and things of that nature. 46-year-old, 48-year-old woman climbing scaffolds.
Apparently she can go right on smoking, though.
Even though she
claims to have a serious lung disease.
Well, I rely upon Schramick, case I cite, Schramick, which says that, that can't be considered because it's very, very difficult.
Can't be considered? What?
It can't be considered because it's so difficult for persons to quit smoking if they've smoked all their lives. People buy patches and they get nicotine things and they do all kinds of things. It's very difficult.
Is there any evidence that she was doing all that?
No, there is not. She at one point says that she quit, and then at another point she says she smokes perhaps a pack or so every other day. And I think that the ALJ tries to make something out of that by saying, well, she can't afford her medications, but she buys cigarettes. Well, if she buys cigarettes, every other day would be like maybe $2 or $3, but one medication prescription can cost you $150. He doesn't ask whether or not she could afford the medications either. But what I was getting at step four is that it's not always possible to say that by placing restrictions on the RFC, that means therefore they are able to do it. In other words, the ALJ must do it just the other way around. He must find out first by assessment of the functional capacity of the claimant whether or not he or she is capable of doing something. Is the person capable of standing and walking 6 hours out of an 8-hour day when they are afflicted, particularly with COPD, emphysema, and shortness of breath?
But didn't she report a pretty high activity level, driving?
The ALJ alleges that, but I think that I would assert, Your Honor, that the ALJ does not take into consideration, because he hasn't made an assessment at step two or at step four, either one, as to how much of the driving does she do, how much shopping, how much walking. He doesn't do that. He doesn't indicate whether or not these kinds of ordinary activities, whether they are equivalent to 5 hours, 5 days a week, 8 hours a day in the workplace. He doesn't do that, and so I would suggest to the court that the case should be reversed or remanded. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Rose. Mr. Sorkin?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Adam Sorkin, and I represent the Commissioner of the Social Security Administration in this matter. Substantial evidence supports the administrative law judge's determination that Eskew was not disabled. The most important thing here is that no doctor ever opined that appellant was unable to work. Indeed, only two physicians ever stated that appellant had any functional limitations, and the ALJ adopted all the limitations that those two doctors set forth. And he adopted even additional limitations, giving appellant the benefit of the doubt. Dr. Breiwaller was appellant's own doctor, and he stated that she could work after March 7, 2005, so long as she was not around smoke, and so long as she didn't lift more than 20 pounds. That was just 3 days after she alleged her her disability
began.
If she is
a smoker, I don't see how she's going to avoid being around smoke.
Well, Your Honor, that's a good point. And the ALJ evaluated that in her credibility determination. She said she couldn't work. She couldn't go back to the sort of industrial factory environment she was working in. And the ALJ noted that she continued to smoke even after two doctors told her that she had to stop. And she alleged disability based on emphysema and chronic obstructive pulmonary disorder.
Your opponent says we're not supposed to take the smoking into account, as I understand.
And I would disagree with opposing counsel on that matter. This court has said that noncompliance is something with medical advice is something that we can take into account. If somebody has said that, you know, they're disabled and yet they don't follow their doctor's advice, then it allows the ALJ to make a credibility determination that maybe they're not as disabled as they are saying that they are. And in this case, two doctors, at least as stated in the medical records, told her that she needed to stop smoking. She clearly would have known that because she was being treated for respiratory distress and respiratory ailments, and yet she did not stop smoking. Aside from her failure to stop smoking, she at points didn't even use her medications. In January of 2006, she stopped using her inhalers because she said her COPD was okay and she was feeling better. Again, that's not what her doctors told her to do. That's what she decided on her own. And so the ALJ can reasonably take that into consideration and say, well, then the fact that you're alleging you're disabled is not as credible because you're not willing to follow your doctor's advice. She also failed to follow up a number of times. She didn't return to the ER when she was told to. She didn't get a CT scan when she was told to. She didn't get a PET scan when she was told to. And it was entirely reasonable for the ALJ to take all this into consideration.
With respect to the ALJ's credibility determination, he uses that phrase, not entirely credible. I'm troubled by that.
The agency adopts some standard language within each opinion. You'll notice that the laying out of the five steps of the process is standard language. These opinions are written for the claimants to understand exactly why they're being denied disability.
Well,
and
does
so
he explain what parts are credible, what parts were credible, and what were not?
I think that he does a very good job of explaining why he found her not to be entirely credible. He said that she said at the hearing that she doesn't do laundry and clean, but she elsewhere in the record she did do laundry and clean. She said that she did. She said that he also discussed the fact that no doctor said she couldn't work, even though she said she couldn't work. Again, he discussed the fact that she continued to smoke, even though she was not supposed to be smoking. He discussed the fact that she didn't take her medications. But the evidence shows that after she did start taking her medications, after she started going regularly to a free clinic after November of 2006, she stopped having to go to the ER for respiratory distress because she was actually following the medical advice, and then her impairments were well controlled with medications. And that's something that the ALJ brought up. So I think that the ALJ discussed a number of times where she didn't follow up, where she was noncompliant, and where the things that she stated didn't match the record as a whole, and that is it makes it clear why she wasn't entirely credible. I'll say that aside from Dr. Brauweiler saying that she shouldn't be around smoke and she shouldn't lift more than 20 pounds, the state agency reviewing physician, Dr. Pilipli, confirmed that appellant could perform light work, including lifting up to 20 pounds, so long as she avoided concentrated exposure to respiratory irritants. And again, these were the only two doctors to give any functional limitations, and the ALJ adopted both of those limitations and more. He restricted her climbing of ladders and ropes and stairs. He said that she could only occasionally balance and stoop and kneel and crouch. Opposing counsel brings up step two in his argument, but it's a misreading of what step two is. The five-step sequential evaluation process is just that. You go through each step, and if you don't pass from one step to the other, the process ends. So it's step one, if you've had substantial gainful activity, well, you've demonstrated you could work and you're not disabled, so we don't move on. At step two, the ALJ took into consideration all of the impairments that she alleged and found that she did have two severe impairments. She had COPD and she had emphysema. You know, there was a couple things that she alleged she had, diabetes and cataracts specifically, and the ALJ didn't find sufficient evidence to show that they were severe. With respect to her diabetes, she said when she went to the ER in March of 2005 that she possibly had it, but the doctor didn't diagnose it, and twice in 2006 she denied that she had it. She never got any testing for it. She never got any treatment for it. Likewise with her cataracts, she said that she had early cataracts, but there was no treatment for that. No doctor ever recommended cataract surgery, and her only visual impairment was that she wore reading glasses, which as a 50-year-old woman is pretty common, or at least unremarkable. So the fact that the ALJ found that there were two severe impairments, he continued on the sequential evaluation process, and he took into consideration the mass in her lungs. There was evidence that it actually got smaller, that it regressed in November of 2006. So that was mentioned in the ALJ's decision. So I think that opposing counsel is incorrect in his argument. If there are no more questions, I will conclude by saying again that only two doctors ever opined that she had functional limitations. The ALJ adopted those. No doctor said that she was disabled. And I'll ask this court to affirm the final decision of the commissioner that appellant is not disabled and not entitled to benefits.
Thank you, Mr. Sorkin. Mr. Rose?
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, let me refer to Schramick versus Opfel, 226 Fed 3rd, 809, and at page 813. It's a Seventh Circuit case, 2000. That's the case where I believe it was, it's the case that says that it's difficult for people to quit smoking. I would like
to. Well, that's certainly true, but if you have a bad case of emphysema, it may get a little easier.
Well, there's no question about it. A person shouldn't smoke at all, whether you have emphysema or not. I fully agree with you. But there is no evidence in the record that would say that a medical opinion stated that stopping smoking would restore Ms. Eskew to the ability to perform SGA. In fact, I have in hearings, I've had MEs, medical experts, who say that doctors shouldn't just tell you to quit smoking. They should say, I, as a doctor, can help you quit smoking. I can do various things for you. But the doctors don't seem to do that. They just tell you to quit smoking and leave you on your own. And it's very difficult to do that. I would also like to point out that the ALJ does not, in connection with follow-up, whether or not she was following up and compliant with her medication and so forth, he doesn't ask why. Can she follow up because she's broke, has no money, or she just reticent to do so. One other point, Your Honor. The not entirely credible has more recently been dealt with by this court, and it has been that particular boilerplate thing has been deemed meaningless boilerplate. And I didn't cite it in my brief because my brief came, I think, before Parker is the reference. It's one of the references to that. Thank you very much for your consideration, Your Honor.
Mr. Rose, thank you, Mr. Sorkin. The case is taken under advisement.